From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Chabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast, and it's good to be back.
It's nice to have you back.
Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed your interview with Dave.
Yeah.
Conversation, interview, whatever.
Interview.
I thought it was good.
No, it was a chat.
Yeah. Dave talked a lot.
Yeah.
I like Dave.
But he was a man on the ground there, you know?
Yeah, he had the on-the-scenes, you know, he had the color, he had the background, he had the story. Like, that's what we need from time to time.
He also, I feel like he's like the writer that really does, out of anyone who covers Scrappy, really has his finger on the pulse and really understands it.
He does, yeah.
So yeah, that was great.
What did you think of our margarita chat, though?
I didn't listen to it. Sorry, I was on vacation.
You were too busy drinking up?
Yeah, I didn't listen to it. Sorry. You guys, listeners, let me know what you thought of it. So, Zach, what have you been reading on the site?
So in a bit of a deviation from what I normally talk about on this this little section here, I want to talk about the piece that we ran, which is, you know, we run these pieces from time to time, kind of covering like things in the food industry or like food, I don't know if you call them even trends, but the like America's regional pizza styles map and stuff was just like, this is such a fascinating topic to me. I know food isn't, and pizza in particular, isn't something we cover a lot here, but it is the odd and strange and very hyper-focused styles of pizza that exist, particularly in the Northeast, are, I don't know, they're like, they weirdly fascinate me. And I think most of all, the ones that seem the grossest, to be honest.
Looking at you, Altoona.
Also, St. Louis style, which I've had rendered once before, not in St. Louis, and was not my favorite. But what I actually want to ask I want to ask you guys two things about this topic. One is, do you have a favorite that's not New York? Because I know what Adam will say. But also, beyond that, the one thing that was sort of missing on here, which maybe because it's almost too broad, is the one style of pizza that I really love that's a regional style, which is tavern style, which is like a kind of upper Midwest thing that is, it's like, to me, it's a really interesting and really delicious rendition because like you get, it's more, you know, it's like Roman style pizza, right? It's like really crispy, light on toppings. I don't know. I really like it.
Is that one that's like cut into small squares?
Yeah.
Yeah, the party cut, as our friend Robert Simonson grew up calling it. So yeah, what are you, for the two of you, like, what's your favorite regional style that's, again, not New York?
So it's not on here either, my favorite regional style.
What is it?
Which if I were...
Well, we need to amend this
If I were from here...
You'd be pissed?
I'd be pissed. And would people already forget that it's part of the city? Staten Island style. Island style is a specific style of pizza. It is not New York style. It is a very thin, crispy pizza. They invented the vodka sauce pie. That's my favorite. I think Staten Island style pizza. I've done the pizza crawls. I think it is the New Haven style. I'm not for a clam pizza, seafood pizza. Fuck right off.
No.
So So I don't really care about the New Haven style pizza. I think New Haven pizza is good, but like, I'm not all for it in the same way. I know I'm gonna piss some people off here, but like, I also think Chicago pizza is not pizza; it's lasagna. So for me, that's like not pizza as well. But the Staten Island style is a real style of pizza that somehow was forgotten because people just thought that New York is one thing and one thing only. And I don't know who's to blame for that editorial misstep, but the editor in chief is on the podcast.
That's
so
true.
Answer for yourself: who came up with these?
I'll discuss it with the team. I haven't had many of these, I have
to
say. I mean, I've had New Haven style. I've had, obviously, New York style, Detroit style, Chicago style. But some of these other ones, I really
Philadelphia style, I knew was a style, but like, I've only had it once.
I'm not really into that.
It's weird.
Where's the cheese, though?
Under, I think.
No cheese.
There's no cheese.
No cheese.
Just like a little parm on top. That's it.
I've never had it.
There's a famous pizzeria now in Philly. I can't remember which one it's called, what the name of it, but it's at one of my niece's, like, I think second year birthday party or something, it was there. And I was like, I've never seen this pizza before. And they were like, this is Philly pizza. So, like, I knew that it was Philly people are very proud of Philly. At least, you know, hopefully by the time you're listening to this, they've been eliminated from the playoffs by the Knicks. fuck Philly. But yeah, the other ones I had, New England Greek style, that was a news to me.
Yeah, no.
Colorado style, I'd never really heard of before, although, like, the dough is made from honey rather than sugar. braided in a thick crust. I mean, I've had that once or twice when I'd gone back to Colorado with my parents, because, you know, my parents lived in Colorado for a long time. That's where I was born. But, like, I don't remember it. California style, like, fuck off, CPK. Like,
come on. Cali barbecue style, chicken pizza.
They, like, literally ruined the 90s. Like, just, yeah.
I feel like they improved the freezer section.
That's what they would say, isn't it?
Yeah. Here's what I will say about California style pizza. Every once in a while, if you are actually in California at the right time, there is something about
CPK.
No. I'm not talking about CPK. I'm talking about like a pizzeria in California. It's like beautiful and sunny, and you're like, yeah, you know, like I just want like avocado and cherry tomatoes on my pizza or something. It kind of works. I think it is maybe of all these styles the one that travels the worst. Like, it does not make sense in winter in like the Northeast. It's like, who the fuck would ever want to eat this? But I do think in its like natural habitat, it makes a lot of sense. I also just love this map because like basically all of the pizza styles of note are east of the Mississippi, which is like, okay, fair enough. I'm not really going to argue with that take. Joanna, what about you?
What have I been reading? I'll tell you what I've been watching. Ooh. How's that?
Sure.
Ooh.
On our YouTube channel, we've rolled out a new series with Olivia White called Time to Taste. And it's where Olivia tastes through celebrity drinks. Isn't that so fun?
That's very funny.
There are a lot of them out there.
There's a lot.
Yeah. So that's a new one that I've really been enjoying lately. In addition to all the great video content we've been doing with Keith and David and Gabrielle and Tim sometimes. But yeah, that's what I've been into. Obviously still reeling from our margarita package last week.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of great content there. What about you, Adam?
So I liked Olivia's piece about whether or not it's the time for Baijiu to shine, because it's obviously kind of, you keep hearing it bubbling up as potentially being the next big thing in spirits. I know there's apparently some of the larger alcohol companies are talking about making big investments in Baijiu and bringing it to the U.S., so I think that's really interesting. And then also another one of like the smaller pieces we do.
Yeah.
I always love when I hear brewers talk about their favorite, like, macro lagers, and so our piece on a bunch of pretty well-known brewers talking, like craft brewers talking about their favorite Mexican lagers, mm-hmm. was fun for me to read because I love Mexican lagers, and of course the majority of them said Modelo.
Yeah.
And just thinking about this weekend and having a cerveza, although I'm going to a wedding on, someone's having a wedding on Cinco de Mayo.
On the Sunday?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's a choice.
Ooh. That's a choice.
That's a choice. So I've already told some friends of ours who I know are also going to be there that we can dip out and go around the corner for chips and guac.
Because, is it local?
Yeah, it's like right here in Gramercy Park.
Oh, nice.
So it should be nice.
Yeah.
It's like one of those private clubs. Like, you know, like the...
The arts? What is it?
Yeah,
arts?
One of those.
National Arts Club?
National Arts Club, I think is where it is.
Oh, nice.
Jackets required for men.
You would wear a jacket anyway.
I know, but it's funny. They like had to let everyone know.
I love the idea of you dipping out for chips and guac in a tux or whatever. That's great.
Yeah,
that's a good image.
Let's do it. So... We are going to have another listener question as this Friday's episode. Again, for those of you that are always wanting to send in questions, we love when you do. All you got to do is record a voice memo on your phone and then email it to us at podcast@vinepair.com, and we will try our best to answer these questions in a timely manner. But Zach, you want to play this week's question?
Hey, Joanna, Zach, and Adam. My name is Kobe. I'm a wine rep for a small mom-and-pop distributor in a more suburban/rural part of Colorado. First off, I want to thank you for the podcast and for your contributions at VinePair. Reading your insights and listening to you really helps me keep up with national trends and is important in helping me position myself in the greater national drinks landscape. As Eric Wallace from Left Hand Brewing discussed recently with Dave Infante on Taplines, grocery store wine entered Colorado in March of last year and has tipped the scales in a titanic way towards bigger corporate wine brands. This state, and my territory in particular, has long known beer as the god of alcoholic drinks. So I spent much of my time as a sales rep trying to figure out how to engage consumers who find the nuances of hazy IPAs accessible at the same time they find the differences between Pinot Noir or Cabernet Sauvignon to be knowledge or class prohibitive. You've talked a lot on the show about this pretension in wine that has sort of boxed out new consumer markets via like a higher than thou navel gazing, especially in natural wine, which I totally agree with. But I've also consistently run into the dilemma that luxury brands of wine have created for the industry. To be clear, I pride myself in being an open, well-rounded wine professional and would probably sooner drink a Napa Cabernet Sauvignon over Natty Glou Glou alcoholic grape juice or whatever the fuck. But you've talked extensively on the podcast about brands like Dow and Veuve Clicquot marketing themselves as luxury lifestyle brands, which made me ask, what responsibility do brands that have poured money specifically into ensuring that wine lives in the American collective consciousness as a luxury category, what responsibility do they take on in the pretension and gatekeeping that permeates this world? What responsibility do brands like Dow and Veuve Clicquot and Camus have in making the average consumer feel afraid to dip their toes in? Thanks.
All right. This is a good one.
Thank you, Kobe.
Thanks, Kobe. Kobe. I'm sure he gets that all the time.
Couldn't resist.
I couldn't. Kobe. So there's been a lot of debate about whether or not Kobe's better than LeBron in the long term, and I would agree, LeBum. Anyways,
don't talk about Kobe anymore. No,
people talk about Kobe all the time. Dude, Lakers fans right now are talking about Kobe like crazy. That he never would have lost in the first round of the playoffs.
I mean,
anyways, that's factually untrue.
But that's cool.
I know, but people like to remember
whatever.
Sure.
In you know
what they want.
There's a lot of NBA talk in this podcast already.
I know. Yeah. Anyways, let's get to this.
Pizza, NBA.
let's get to this today. People like already turned it off.
Yeah.
I think this is a really good question. My answer to you, Kobe, is going to be that actually what you are seeing in the market is exactly what these luxury brands intend for you to see in the market, which is that if you look at like traditional luxury marketing, the entire idea of exclusivity is that the market is very opaque, right, is very hard to understand, and there is a gatekeepiness to a luxury market, right? So you need to have knowledge in order to enter that market. That's what makes the good a luxury good in the first place. So if you think about it from the vantage point of, let's look at like high-end cars, right? You need to understand at the very top level, right? Not the entry level high end cars. I'm not talking about like you're just going to buy a Mercedes, but you want to start really trading up to G wagons, etc. You want to have an understanding of what makes that car special in the first place. There's knowledge that you need to possess in order to understand why you would buy that car in the first place. Now, of course, there are going to be people that will ultimately buy that car anyways, just because they're rich or they're an oligarch or something like that, right? But for the most part, people who want to feel intelligent about why they made that purchase are going to do a lot to learn about the luxury car market before they enter it. Same with watches, right? So you have Rolex as your sort of like general, you know, every kind of person luxury watch that everyone knows. It's the brand that is, you know, on all the tennis nets during Wimbledon, etc. But then there are other like Breitling, Tudor, which is made by Rolex, other luxury brands that you need to learn about in order to understand and participate in the market. And Rolex does a very good job of helping to gatekeep that market, right? So they also aren't doing any education on their own, right? They're not trying to help their consumer understand the luxury watch market, right? They're just saying, we're the biggest, like Veuve. So use it as an entry point. But then, you know, you kind of figure it out for yourself after that. That's because that's how you keep a luxury market luxury,
right?
Is you actually continue to build this moat around the market. So, you know, a quick answer to your question is like, no, like they don't need to, nor do they want to do anything to help further wine culture.
Or make it more accessible.
Yeah, for anyone that is not going to enter it on the luxury spectrum, right? The job of making wine accessible actually does come from the grocery store wines. They are the entry point to the wine market for most consumers, and they are the people who should be doing the education. And they actually, if you look at the largest brands in the world and the people, you know, making the most money, are the grocery brands. And whether they like being called grocery store brands or not, like that is what they are. And they are the ones that are the ambassadors for wine culture to the majority of people just getting into wine. They're the ones that should be hopefully teaching the difference between Pinot Noir, Cabernet, etc. And they're the ones that are doing favors potentially to the luxury market if you have someone that enters it when they're, you know, 20, 21, 22, not 20. You know, start drinking wine in college. They enter at the grocery store because they see these brands. Maybe they trade up on the shelves in the grocery store. Veuve usually is still in the grocery store on the top shelf. And then they say, I want to learn enough about it that I'm going to now get into wine and try to understand the different, you know, areas of Barolo, the different growths of Bordeaux, the different producers in Napa. But usually that's because either they enter it at a young age through the grocery store or they just have money and they enter it straight at the top in the beginning. And then, you know, they figure it out on their own because they have money to make those choices.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you sort of point out that a lot of these higher-end luxury brands really are disinterested in kind of dispelling myths and making wine feel more accessible. I think that squares with kind of how they tend to act in the market and kind of how they are positioned. You know, we've talked a lot about how, you know, the LVMH wine brands don't talk about their brands the way that a lot of wines talk about themselves. They don't talk about terroir particularly. They don't talk about, you know, the vineyard and all the things that go into it. They talk about and they sort of market around the feel you get. And in that regard, the product is almost immaterial, right? It fits in along with a lifestyle that the presumed luxury good consumer wants to live, feels like they want to live. And the bottle of Veuve Clicquot is the accessory to that, just as the fancy watch or the scarf or the shoes or whatever are. They're not seen as different because one is one is wine or one is a consumable or one is an agricultural product or whatever. But I do think that in addition to the grocery store brands that are obviously the point of access and entry for a lot of people and perhaps have a degree of responsibility, although I also don't think they tend to contribute to the sort of gatekeeping and stigma that Kobe is expressing in this question, and I think we talk about a lot. I also think it's where, you know, the luxury good comparison is, I think, a really interesting one. And Adam and Joanne, I'm curious your thoughts on this, because I think about sometimes how with wine, you have a lot of the producers and the distributors and whatnot that are looking to, in some way or another, target some of the market that is drawn to a Veuve Clicquot, a Camus, a Dow, or whatever, right? People who are willing to spend a fair bit of money on a bottle of wine because they have that money to spend and are doing so because it fits, they hopefully, you know, like the way it tastes and all that, but it also is about the aesthetic. It is about the lifestyle and what it says about them. And I think you see in a lot of other luxury goods is smaller kind of artisanal bespoke producers looking to be like, okay, sure, yes, you could go buy a Rolex, but wouldn't you rather have a watch of perhaps superior quality, much less limited production? And yes, maybe not everyone will look at it and know what it is, but, you know, the people who know will know. And that, I think, is where the wine industry, where its sense of snobbery comes from, because and sort of the gatekeeping comes from. Because in the end, Veuve Clicquot is a widely available product. As Adam said, it's in grocery stores coast to coast. You can find it, in every chain retailer of every kind. You can find these other bottles that we're talking about. They are luxury goods, but they are also produced at scale that anyone who has the dollars to buy them can buy them. And where I think wine's gatekeeping vibe comes from is the fact that a lot of the high-end wines, a lot of the expensive wines, a lot of the wines that wine professionals and the like talk about are not just expensive, but they're limited production. They are hard to get. And that element of it, I think, is maybe innate to the industry. It is. I'm not saying there is an easy way to solve this problem, but I think that a lot of the conversation about this ignores the fact that those wines that we rave about, that we talk about, are in many cases inherently limited production, have a gatekeeping element to them because there's just not much of it out there. And getting your hands on it is difficult. And it's not just about walking into the store in your neighborhood or in your town and plunking down the cash. It's a lot more complicated than that. I wish I had an answer, a solution, but that is, I think, a big part of the problem.
Yeah, that reminds me of our cult wines conversation too, right? It's like that's the added layer on top of just something being like a wine being expensive, is that it's hard to get now and not many people actually know about it. You have to be in certain circles to know about it. I think another reason why it's not the responsibility of these luxury brands to make wine more accessible for everyone is that a lot of these brands are part of bigger portfolios where they have the grocery store brands already to make to make that money. And so, you know, the sales goals for those bigger, the luxury brands can be separate from that, right? It doesn't, it's not like a, what is the phrase that's like a rising tide?
Lifts all boats.
It's not like that.
No.
Right? And so they can afford for these segments to be very separate.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the entire idea with most luxury markets is that you want to create an environment in which there's multiple people that have multiple pieces of information, right? So not everyone fully understands the market. I mean, this is very, very, very common in art, right? So like, you know, there are a few people that sort of fully understand the market and what's going to be worth money, what's worth buying, what's not. And then there are other people that want to enter the market, right? And so either you do a lot of work to study the market in order to enter the market, or you pay somebody to tell you what to do. And the luxury wine market is no different, which is why basically that market is always going to be made up of a few major regions and then once in a while brands from outside those major regions that everyone deems to be the best. Like one of them I think of is like Vega Sicilia.
Or like Enfold Grange, right? So like, or something like that.
Right. There's not a lot of people collecting the rest of the wines of Ribera del Duero, but they're drinking Vega Sicilia, right? So that is – and you need to know that. Someone has to teach you that, right? So it's like, oh, not – you know, if you had no knowledge whatsoever, you might say, oh, so Vega Sicilia is this incredible wine from this region. I should buy the other more affordable wines in that region because won't they also be collectible? And it's actually, no, they won't, because Vega Sicilia has done a lot of work with the brand, with the image, with the score, with everything, that the auction market just is always going to consider this to be a premier wine. And that is not Vega Sicilia's job to explain that to you, right? And so that's why these brands just don't care to do that, right? Like you either are able to enter because of means or because of studying, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always going to be the issue that wine has over the other major alcohol groups, is that wine will always have at the very high end this hard to access luxury market. Yeah. It has, because historically it has been both a product for the people. Right, the people working the fields drank really affordable field blends, et cetera, because it was safer to drink than water. And then you had at the very high end the nobility drinking wine as well, and they were drinking much nicer stuff than the people, the peasants. Right. And we're seeing that in the same way. Whereas, like beer, it's kind of an every person drink, right? Even on the really cool nuances that you talk about, Kobe, of like.
Yeah,
like,
with the hazies, you know,
the hazies
and stuff. Yeah.
Like, it's still, it's a very democratized beverage. That's why people like beer. That's why even when I was discussing the beginning of the podcast, like the article that I liked, brewers have no problem telling you the cheap beer they also like to drink, right? That a lot of brewers who brew the most expensive beers in the world, which still will never come anywhere near the prices of the high-end wines we're talking about, will tell you that they on, like, when they're done brewing, like to drink a High Life. Right, you don't have a lot of winemakers who say when they're done with a day of work making Vega Sicilia or Scream Eagle, whatever, they really can't wait to drink, you know, Kim Crawford. Yeah. Like that's just not it's not the same. There's whether or not you believe what you want to believe about Kim Crawford, right? It is a well-made Sauvignon Blanc at an affordable price that is consistently what a wine from New Zealand should taste like at that price point. But that doesn't mean that the luxury market considers that a luxury wine. That's not a luxury wine. That's a, you know, very accessible Sauvignon Blanc. So I think that's something that we always are going to have to grapple with in wine. And the only thing that really is like this in spirits is scotch. And we talk about this all the time. It's the only thing that potentially is like wine, where it's a more difficult area to understand. Maybe there's parts of bourbon now, but kind of, I don't really think there is. It's still very accessible. All you got to know if you really want to collect at this point is like just buy anything Buffalo Trace makes and you're fine.
Bourbon, yeah.
And you're fine. Like, but there are still some of those like diamonds in the rough trying to understand scotch and the nuances of single malt specifically. But otherwise, like spirits as well is pretty accessible. And they all try to educate you about the category, et cetera. And they all kind of believe that the rising tides lifts all boats thing.
So I guess my question then is like, given where wine is right now,
yeah,
right? And not a not great place. do we think that these luxury brands should do more to get people in the wine funnel?
No.
Because it will never affect them.
They're fine. They're fine. The super high-end wines are fine. The ones that have, you know, continued to establish themselves as, you know, connoting something about who you are and what it says about you by drinking them, they are fine. Burgundy is fine. Barolo is fine. Veuve Clicquot is fine.
Some of those regions might have their own challenges, but they're not this.
Right. Right. They're not this. It's not what we've been taught. It's not the doom and gloom we're talking about. I do think the responsibility continues to be at the entry and mid-level of wine, and for those companies and those brands to take bigger risks and talk about drinking in very different ways and to talk about accessibility and try in any way possible to get people to enter the category.
And wine professionals.
Yes, and wine professionals. And that means more than just taking the traditional route, even though I said I do think at the, you know, earlier in this podcast, I said I do think that the more accessible wine brands do have a responsibility to try to educate you on varietals, et cetera. I don't mean that the only thing they should do is take the very traditional route of marketing wine. I think that in some ways they should, in other ways they should fully embrace like wine and wings and full promotions where like you should drink wine and eat. Do you know that buffalo wings is the fastest growing food category in America? Like, what
people
the
chicken wings.
Fucking crazy. So like, why aren't we just talking about drinking wine and eating wings?
Right.
WW.
Yeah.
Wine and wings. Like Wine Wing Wednesdays. Like I think that is something that they are responsible for as well. They need to think about taking risks in the way that honestly Stella Rosa has taken.
Yep, I was just thinking that.
I mean, as Josh put in our Slack channel recently, right? Like he said, who else, what other wine brand would have the balls? Seriously, the guts, whatever you want to call it, to come out with a Cinco de Mayo promotion promoting their spicy pineapple wine as the Cinco de Mayo drink of choice. Yeah. Only them. That's something to be at least, you know, to at least acknowledge and be like, whoa, they took a risk. They're taking a risk. They're trying to bring people in. And so I think that's why the responsibility does lie there. And I, you know, I feel for the retailers who don't love that the grocery stores have started to sell wines. And that's what's happening to Kobe in Colorado.
Right.
And I do think that does 100% change a wine market. And it changes how you potentially can, you know, understand wine, because your relationship with the retailer fundamentally changes. You just are never going to be in a grocery store and find anyone that is going to be as helpful as they would in an independent shop. And that is why I think New York is, you know, the shop owners have lobbied so aggressively to try to stop the big grocery store chains from ever being able to sell wine. But in some cases, that affordable wine is an entry point. I think Trader Joe's and Costco have done a lot for American wine culture. And to dismiss that is fucking stupid.
And I want to add one other point here, and I think to maybe help kind of address one of the things that Kobe mentioned in his question, which is I think for smaller producers, smaller distributors, smaller retailers, some of this feels kind of like overwhelming. Like, how are you ever going to do anything that stands out from or competes against or even kind of, you know, engages with some of these very large brands, some of these really large categories? And I think the most important thing is to take note of what Adam's saying and what we're saying, which is that so many wine drinkers are coming to you or you're coming in contact with them, and their frame of reference is these widely available and widely recognized wines. And whether they're the luxury wines at the high end, whether they're the grocery store wines at a lower price point. And what one of the biggest things that the wine industry has, I think, really struggled with, and in particular wine professionals, be they sommeliers, retail operators, et cetera, is engaging with those drinkers and those wines on their own terms. I mean, look, we all can imagine, we can all can envision, and probably lots of us can recount experiences where our wine knowledge is, we feel insecure about it, and that's almost everyone in wine, anyone who drinks wine or even works in wine in a lot of cases, and someone has condescended to us about the things we like to drink, whether it's your Kim Crawford Sauvignon Blanc, whether it's your, you know, Santa Margarita Pinot Grigio, whatever the thing it is that you drank, you know, your, you know, whatever. And again, I just implore the professionals who listen to this to really try to reconsider your stance on these things. Look, those may not be wines you want to drink, although I do think it's important if you want to consider yourself a real professional to taste those wines from time to time. I mean, one of the reasons why I'm really glad that Joanne and I tried the aforementioned Stella Rosa spicy pineapple wine is like, it's popular. And that their whole line of wines is very popular, is growing rapidly. And so we're going to come in contact with people whose favorite wine is a Stella Rosa wine, whose point of entry into wine is Stella Rosa wine. And if we both condescend to those people and also have no idea what they're talking about, how are we ever going to engage with them, interest them in other wines, perhaps expand their interest in wine to other things that we also think are great? And it's really important to not come into those kinds of interactions, those kinds of encounters with wine drinkers or potential wine drinkers with an air of snobbery. I mean, Adam mentioned that you just don't see this in beer. You don't see it in spirits to the same extent, right? If someone walks into a tap room and says their favorite beer is Miller High Life, the brewery is not going to be like, well, get the fuck out of here. What are you doing? They're going to be like, great, here's a lager. Here's a pilsner. Here's a something that's our closest analog. And yeah, it's more expensive. And yeah, it's not as widely available. And maybe it's not the thing you're going to drink on every occasion. Maybe you're still going to drink Miller High Life 90% of the time. But we're not going to tell you that you're not a good beer drinker because that's your favorite beer. And wine, mm-hmm. and again, it's generalization. There's lots of people I know who are really good about this, but there are many more who aren't and aren't even aware that this is a blind spot, who treat the person who walks in saying that their favorite wine is something that is produced at scale, that is heavily marketed, that is widely available, and they can't even engage with that person without perhaps condescending to them or being unaware of what draws people to those wines. And if that's you, like, you got to rethink this, because you're just not, it's not going to work to come at that interaction that way. You're going to have much more success hearing that, taking it in and saying, okay, cool. Like, here's something I've got that is going to be like that. Or here's something that might be interesting as a jumping off point. Or here's that same variety or style made by someone else. And, you know, that's not going to land with everyone. For some people, it is about the price point. It is about the availability, about the consistency. But for a lot of people, they're afraid to enter into that conversation on the consumer side because they're afraid they'll get judged. And they're not wrong to have that fear. That is an experience that a lot of people have. And it, frankly, it sucks.
Yeah. And look, and this is why I guess I'm saying it's much more the responsibility of the low end than the high end, because you're much more likely to have the consumer that walks in and has the example of the grocery store wine that they like, mm-hmm. than to have the consumer that walks in that says to the somm, well, yeah, I'm a huge, I don't know, like, Lafite drinker. Right?
But you do get a lot of people who are... I'm a big Camus drinker. I'm a big Dow drinker. Those kinds of things.
But at least I find those people, they're often going to restaurants where if the place is smart, like a huge steakhouse, they have that on the menu.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. And if not, the steakhouse or whatever knows what else to sell them.
Yeah.
You know, it's the reaction to like the I'm an apothic drinker, yeah. or I'm a... you know, Kim Crawford drinker, et cetera, where I think people should be better about that. If you're a pothead drinker, okay, cool, so you like red blends. Like, let's help find you, let's move you along this path, right? Like, I can give you a really great Malbec or whatever people might have. And I think, again, instead people just say, oh, okay. Right. And that's the bad attitude, which is what you're saying.
Or you don't even really know what apothic is. You don't know what it tastes like. You don't have any idea why people like it. And you aren't really able to, because I mean, you have to be able to solve that quote unquote problem. You have to be able to make suggestions that are going to make that person feel comfortable and welcomed in. And yeah, it doesn't mean that you have to carry those exact wines. Yep. You just have to have an honest and earnest answer and suggestion or suggestions for people who say that, you know, any of these things are their favorite wines and or the things they tend to drink. And, you know, that's just, again, that's just part of service. In the same way that if someone walks into a restaurant and tells you that their favorite food is, you know, is chicken wings, well, it doesn't mean that you have to have chicken wings on the menu, but maybe you should have some idea why people like chicken wings and what they taste like. And you could perhaps suggest something on the menu. I mean, that's a little silly. Most people are more comfortable placing a food order than they are making a wine order, but still, you know, you get the point. So I don't know. It bugs me when people treat this entire massive part of the wine industry as something they don't need to know anything about.
I feel like Keith did this really well to me today. Actually, we're looking at some of the Chardonnays that it's going to be on the Chardonnay list coming out later this week. It came out this week, right?
Today.
Week. Yeah. Came out today. well, we record before Fridays, guys. So, okay.
Thursday.
Sorry, guys. sorry. But he said, this Chardonnay for me is the ultimate Chardonnay to appeal to like the mom that likes, I mean, again, it's a stereotype, but whatever. The mom that likes the Rombauer style and the kid that likes the Chablis style, right? And he was like, this does both for both people. And, like, that is kind of what Zach's talking about. Like, that's what we need from wine professionals, is to be able to understand that and have had both of those styles of wines regularly to be able to help people when they're out by the one style that everyone will like. So the kid doesn't say to the mom, ugh, gross. And the mom doesn't say to the kid, ugh, gross. Right? And everyone feels like they're getting a great wine that they all can enjoy. And that's what wine needs to do a much better job of. This is not supposed to be what this podcast is about. We're talking about luxury. But at the end of the day, that's not luxury's job. Luxury's job is to create a market that makes you signal to everyone else that you are successful, that you have arrived, that you have money, and that you can afford it. And that is a very, that is what Burgundy and Champagne and Barolo do very well. And go to those regions, and that's what they do well in those regions too. Yeah. That's what they do. So Napa does too. Like, sorry, that is what Napa is. Like, and Napa, even on the accessible front, right? Even on the Ashes and Diamonds that I've talked about a bunch front, Ashes and Diamonds is very much luxury.
Yeah.
It might be luxury for a different generation, but it is a very much a luxury experience. So let us know what you think at podcast@vinepair.com. And again, please send us your questions. They're really fun to answer. So send them on in. Kobe, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you both on Monday.
Have a nice weekend.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.